Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 26th episode of Real Blend, a podcast that has as much screen time in Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom as Jeff Goldblum does. My name is Sean O'Connell, and I'm the managing director here at Cinema Blend. And let's start off introductions this week with the man who had Goldblum's legendary fingers running through his hair, Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Sir, how are you?
I'm doing well. More like tapping the top of my hair. If you've ever met me, you know that it is impossible to run your fingers through my hair.
That is not how I have this fantasy playing out, Jake.
Just one of many, Sean.
Well, not to be outdone, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. also interviewed Jeff Goldblum, but didn't get a finger run through his spectacular do. Kevin, how are you?
This is true. I did not get a finger through my hair, but... I do want to give you credit for your Goldblum pun at the beginning. Those are my favorite moments of the week, and I know that those are very hardcore in regards to writing, so thank you very much for that.
What an awkward cameo that is. We will talk about Fallen Kingdom later on in the show.
Essentially what Kevin just said was the peak of the show is within the first 30 seconds, and then it's all downhill.
Then you all can punch out if you want to. So much show to get to today. We are very thrilled that you are all joining us for our weekly conversation regarding all things cinematic. If you happen to be watching us on Cinema Blend's Facebook page, hello. Drop us comments in the section and drop us questions and comments, and Gabe behind the glass will forward them over to us if there's things you want answered during the show. Speaking of shout-outs, I mentioned that I was going to start reading iTunes reviews here on the show, and when I mentioned that I was going to do that, we got another one. So
hey,
I'm going to go ahead and do that. Our latest review comes to us from someone named Joshua Ziggy Popkin, who writes, open quote, "This is my favorite podcast ever. It is so engaging, and they are always discussing the latest movie news and gossip." I didn't know that we did gossip. Do we do gossip?
I guess sometimes. That's movie gossip, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Celebrity here's and theirs.
Stop knocking the review, Sean.
I'm just questioning it. I love listening to them argue about their favorite movies and filmmakers, which we do a lot. They have wonderful chemistry and are very personable. Highly recommended. P.S. It's fun listening to how many times Kevin says no question. Now I didn't pick up on that.
Kevin said no question.
Yeah,
I think it's one of my verbal crutches. I have many of them,
and that's no question.
No question.
That's probably one of them. Yeah, no question. Yeah.
Someone pointed out to me once that I say absolutely a lot in interviews. And from that moment on, I don't know if you watch How I Met Your Mother, but it was like that episode of How I Met Your Mother where like the glass shatters and they realize just how much you really say. For me, it was really how much I say the word absolutely.
Right.
And it would be a really unfortunate drinking game if you took a shot every time I say absolutely.
I really say
it a lot.
And now you guys have both done live TV. I'm sure that if you went back and watched your earliest appearances, you probably have like verbal crutches that you've leaned on and that you totally relied on heavily early on.
Yeah. Oh, I have some really bad ones. I say like seriously or essentially, persnickety. I have a lot of different ones that I say on the air. I don't know why.
Persnickety?
Persnickety is a great word. I probably overuse it though. It's like means like nitpicking or like,
I know, but that's not like a word that one casually uses.
Apparently, I use it a lot. That and essentially, and then I think basically, I think I use a lot as well. I like the E, the words that end in Y sound,
right.
I think.
Wow. Well, as you guys are picking up on the podcast too, we do this on a regular basis also. So thank you, Joshua, for the review this week. And if anybody else wants to drop one, you can go over to our iTunes page. Please subscribe to our show. Please leave us star ratings. Please leave us reviews. We are also on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere the podcasts are served. And like I said, if you guys leave us a review, I'm going to try to start reading them at the top of the show. So let's get to news. So today's show, just to run through quick, we're going to go over news. We're going to do some Incredibles box office talk and get into a spoiler conversation about Incredibles. We're going to react to Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, but we won't give full-on reviews because we want people to be able to go see it. Although Jake and I were talking about this beforehand. Kevin, do you know how much money that movie has made worldwide so far?
Jurassic?
Yes.
I think I saw a number. It's like over $400 million, right? Or something
it's
like that.
It's close to it. It's like $347.
Like $397. Oh, wow. That's crazy.
I couldn't believe how much money that thing has earned before even opening here in the States.
I think so. It opened
Does it make a billion dollars?
100%.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. If you guys remember when we did that, what movie not named Infinity War is going to win the box office? I think I won Kevin over to the Jurassic side because the first one did so well.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, this...
we all know how my pick turned out.
Jake picked Solo. I was drinking water.
You didn't have to reiterate, Sean.
Yeah, that was a bad one. It was bad.
I don't think Jurassic World will have the. I don't know. What was Jurassic World's final number? The first one was it was like a billion six. Was it that high? Was it?
I think
was
so.
It, okay, I don't know. I don't know if it'll go that high. But I think it'll definitely get a billion. I mean, what's the projected opening weekend for the U.S.? 140.
140. Yeah, 140. Yeah. I've seen.
All right.
So well, I mean,
which is funny. Like 140 is a big number, and I don't feel like there's a ton of buzz for it going into tomorrow, going into this weekend. Then again, the last one opened to 200 million, and I never would have thought that would have happened. So I think Jurassic is one of those movies that like families will just get up and go see.
Right.
I think that's one of those short of Jurassic Park 3. I think that's one of the, which didn't do horribly. I think that's one of those movies that. One of those series that's going to be around for a while.
I do think the first Jurassic World had that Force Awakens vibe to it, though, where...
Oh, totally.
Yeah, like where I think there was a lot going into it in the sense of it's been a while since we've seen this story or this character or whatever. So I think even though Jurassic World was different characters, I think that there was... It's all in the same universe. I think there was this excitement about it. So globally, the opening for Jurassic World, I think it all opened similar timing versus now... We opened globally, I think, the 6th of June, and then we go to the U.S. this weekend. So it's weird. I don't know why it was staggered like that, because then it takes away from that opening number, that big number that we'll have opening weekend. So I don't know. It's interesting why they... I always wonder why things get staggered like that. I've seen it happen with superhero films. And Deadpool 2 hasn't even opened in China yet, from what I understand.
Wow, that's crazy. So really? It's been
a
while.
That movie's made $690 million worldwide so far, and it hasn't even opened in China yet, so I don't even know what that, if it will, if it, didn't Rob Liefeld say it will open in China, didn't he say?
Yes.
Yeah, he said it will. He said that it was, you know, for I think for all intents and purposes, he said that they were essentially adjusted to make sure that it could open in China.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm interested to see what happens, so.
We got to point out the fact that today is a very special anniversary for a movie that we all adore, 43 years to the date. Steven Spielberg released Jaws in theaters. 43 is a weird anniversary. It's not like a big round number, but it's always worth
talk about Jaws.
Pointing out the fact that, yeah, absolutely. It invented the summer blockbusters. I think when we were talking about Psycho for Hitchcock Blend, I think Jaws capitalized a lot on that in terms of driving people out to the theaters and sort of protecting the secrets about what's going to happen in the movie. And Jake, you put that cool thing on Twitter asking people to talk about their first experiences with it. And a number of people commented about how it scared them out of the water, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's probably whenever I talk about movie experiences that I wish I had had, I think that's probably number one on my list. Because you hear people's stories about seeing it when it came out in 75 and how it really not just impacted, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, not just, you know, affected people personally in terms of being afraid to go into the water. People lost their businesses. Beachside businesses went out of business because no one went to the beach that year, which is, right. I mean, that's the power of movies, man. I'm not saying that's a good power of movies, but that's power.
I can't think of anything like... comparable to that, like a modern thing that affected culture that way.
Nothing.
Sorry, Kevin.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, in regards to the idea of seeing a film and being a part of a moment or a movement in cinematic history, I always feel like Jaws would be one of them, as Jake said, but the other one, I think, would have been Psycho, only because...
Psycho would have been cool.
Just the idea of people not coming in the theater 20 minutes into the film, I love that they stopped people from doing so. And I think, I wish more filmmakers like Hitchcock would enforce something like that. I know that there's some theater chains, from what I understand, I think Alamo might be one of them, I could be wrong, that doesn't allow it doesn't allow people to walk in after a certain time. And I don't know if that's the case. I remember reading somewhere or heard that somewhere, but I kind of hope that
I would
that
be okay
day,
with that.
That me too. I hope that day returns. That once the film starts, you are no longer able to go in, because the 20-minute in person who walks in and has to come down your row in the opening of a movie. I imagine watching Saving Private Ryan, and then like someone's like, you have to get up out of your chair to let somebody go by you in the middle of that scene. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. So I'm all for people going to the movie theaters, but I'm all for that, you know, that logic of that, you know.
But you know, one thing that I'm guilty of, if we go to a screening, I don't know if you guys do this. When I go to a screening, if I'm super early or if I'm out of a movie screening and I know that like there's an hour left in Infinity War, I'll go in and watch the last hour. Or if I get to something early, I'll go in and watch like the first half hour of Deadpool.
Yeah, you won't climb over somebody. You'll walk in and go to the front.
I sit right on people's laps.
And well, that was
snack.
You.
No, I sit right in the front. I go to the first seat that's like open right as I come around the corner, and I sit down. And I know everybody looks at me like, "Why is that person coming in? There's like an hour left." But I just want to see the end of Infinity War again. I just like.
I've done that before for sure. And you mentioned Jaws, by the way. I was interviewing Benicio del Toro the other day for Sicario, Day of Soldado, and we were talking about
name drop. Sweet name.
Well, and I'm not name dropping. I'm just remembering something that he said to me about the Jaws theme, because we were talking about Johan Johansson's theme for Sicario, and because Johan Johansson's no longer with us, unfortunately, brilliant composer, young guy, died very early. But that score he had for Sicario, that very deep resonating, I don't even know what to call it. But anyways, so we were talking about that, and he compared that to Jaws in regards to the anxiety it makes you feel. He said it made it feel like he was hungry. Right. That was the sound. I thought that was an interesting topic, the idea of having that type of score moving you emotionally and kind of like making you feel that anxiety. So I thought that was an interesting comparison. I actually agree with him.
So tonight, if you're happen watching the live show, put Jaws on tonight. Just put it on the background. You know, do something for its anniversary. I'd say celebrate it. If you're listening to this after the fact, you missed it. I'm sorry. I want to move on to
Don't worry. Next year is 44.
Yes, we'll see you back here on June 20th. Right before we started this podcast, news broke that I thought would be really interesting to everybody who's listening, and of course, interesting to Jake. The Star Wars anthology film. No, they're not the anthology films. Are they the anthology films? What are they calling
stories.
The solo ones? The stories?
The stories.
Things
yeah,
like
Star
Rogue
Wars
Nation, things like Rogue One, things like Solo, things like the planned Obi-Wan and Boba Fett movie that had been announced are now, according to Collider, being put on pause because of the disappointing performance of Solo. And so I'm curious, Jake, do you think, and Kevin, of course, do you think that's a good idea? Is it time for them to sort of circle the wagons, regroup, figure out the next big steps? According to this report, what they would focus on next would be the Rian Johnson trilogy or the trilogy from the Game of Thrones guys. I think that's odd, considering the fan base seems to be pretty upset with Rian Johnson at the moment. So if you tell me you're going to double down on a trilogy from him, that seems like an odd message to send, but what are your thoughts about this decision, if this is in fact what they're doing?
For me, it's less about what the movie, you know, the standalones or the trilogies or whose trilogy it was, and more about like maybe we just don't get. And trust me, I love getting Star Wars movies. When a Star Wars movie is out, it is like my Christmas. But maybe we just don't get one every year, rather than completely wipe away the stories, because I loved the idea of getting a Boba Fett story. I'm bummed that we're not going to get that next, maybe that Boba Fett movie or the Lando movie that crosses over with Solo. I was excited about that. Maybe we just let the anticipation, but maybe we do it every other year. And we walk out of a theater going, oh, you know, 24 months into the next one. And I think also on a side note, the thing that also bothers me about this is there's a group of internet trolls out there that really thinks that this is their accomplishment,
right?
That, you know, they were so anti-Solo, and they've been, these are the people that you know try to kick Kelly Marie Tran off the internet, and even though they had genuinely nothing to do with this, they're going to bed at night thinking that they have a victory, thinking that they caused this, and deep down that kind of bothers me.
You don't think they had any impact?
No, because I don't think there's enough people to have really made the difference. I think over the general public wasn't interested in seeing Solo. I don't think because 18 losers in their parents' basement didn't go see Solo that all of Lucasfilm is changing the direction that they're taking their entire company.
Right.
Yeah, it's, I mean, to me, it's definitely the right move. I mean, we are experiencing extreme Star Wars fatigue, unfortunately. And 5-6 months after Last Jedi, to release another Star Wars movie was just not a great move, obviously. Also, that film had a ton of bad press leading into it. I think they should have stuck with the original filmmakers. I think that there should have been... when you hire a director to make a movie, you know what that filmmaker is going to be bringing to the table in regards to content and tone. So why let them go if they're not following along with clearly what the vision was from Lawrence and his son, the screenwriters for the film? But I would imagine that they had problems with the same things that I had problems with in that script. I'll never know that for sure, but it's just my assumption. But I think that the 6 month mark after Last Jedi, especially with that film having such polarizing criticisms, I think going into that movie, people were just Star Wars. They were just tired of Star Wars at the moment, which I completely understand. So I think every year and a half, 2 years probably is the smarter way to go. Like Jake was saying, I don't think that a Star Wars film every year is getting to a point where that's becoming more of like a joke. Like, yeah. Oh, here's another one. I mean, like why? I don't really understand who decided to move it to May. I heard Ron Howard had something to do with the release date. I don't know if that's true or not in regards to bringing it to the summer. But that was one of the most crowded summers I've ever seen before in my life in regards to Avengers Infinity War and
just
Deadpool.
Crowded May. It's like not even just the summer, because I feel like the summer has slowed down. That May was insane. Yeah.
Well, but even if Solo came out today or this week before Jurassic World, I still don't think it would have done that well. I think people were just really kind of... People go to the movie theaters to see Star Wars, but making it a yearly thing, it's like it's way too much. It's entirely too much.
So Star Wars absolutely had some hubris. Like, they definitely felt... And why not, right? I would too. Like, they felt, we're Star Wars, and if we put something out, people are going to come. I don't think there's anything wrong at all with them very quickly getting the lesson from this gut check of, oh, people aren't going to turn out to just anything that we turn out. So let's literally put all of our attention into Episode 9, make that a really memorable film, and make sure that the films that come after it are properly constructed and that the screenwriter matches the director and that the tone is what we want to do. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, because otherwise plowing ahead makes you, you know, the DC universe where they just keep going ahead with titles that they don't care about.
Speaking of DC universe, is this the moment where Lucasfilm realizes that they're not Marvel and that they're not going to be Marvel?
Yeah.
Because
yes.
I feel like they were moving in the direction of really wanting to be Marvel, where they could put out 3 films a year and each one would do better than the last. And I think this is one of those things where it's just like, maybe you're not. And I mean, there's a reason that DC has tried to be Marvel and failed. And it's just because that takes a little bit of oomph that maybe just does it. And also variety that I'm not sure that Star Wars films can have. I don't know, like, if we can get a really weird, wacky Star Wars movie. I mean, do we live in, no pun intended, do we live in that universe where we can get, you know, the Doctor Strange of Star Wars movies or the Thor Ragnarok of Star Wars movies? I mean, do those movies even exist?
I don't know. Maybe. In time. I mean, we're talking about the 17th, 16th, and 17th version.
Yeah, exactly. They earned that.
Yeah.
Remember how, not, I don't want to say generic the early Marvel films were, but a little cookie cutter in that sense.
Sure. Absolutely. And so maybe these are just growing pains for that universe and it'll get to where it's going eventually. Talking about franchises that are building... Rocky 7 put out a trailer today.
Hey!
I'm curious what you guys are. What's your anticipation level for Creed 2 on a scale of 1 to 10?
Personally, I thought the first Creed was phenomenal. I mean, it was just an incredibly executed film. From a filmmaking standpoint, from a performance standpoint, I thought Stallone should have won the Academy Award that year. It was amazing. And I think Coogler just, God, the way he directed that movie, just the cinematography, the tracking shots, everything.
Are you concerned he's not back?
100%. I'm 100% confirmed he's not concerned he's not back. I don't feel a necessary want for another continuation of that story. I love the way Creed.
But Drago, dude. Drago.
Yeah, I mean, it's gonna. But I will say, I mean, the well cut trailer can immediately turn your mind the other way around. And you know, you throw Kendrick Lamar onto a trailer like with DNA and edit it the way you do with the punching bag. It's like,
yeah,
it got me excited. So I was really, really into the trailer. So it kind of turned me around on it. I had no interest, and I love the first one, but with Ryan Coogler gone, and a different filmmaker stepping in, which I have no problem giving another chance to, I just was a little concerned about why they were making another film. But it's cool. The DNA Kendrick track really kind of got me going. It was very
is
well
this
done.
The Sicario Day of the Soldado of Creed movies, where it's just like, yeah, it'll be nice. Yeah, it's going to be cool to see it, but the original guy's not coming back, so I care significantly less about
That's
it.
That's an interesting comparison.
Well, Soldado has no Deacons, no Denis, no Johan Johansson. That's not his fault. I mean, obviously, Johan Johansson, his music still is now put into this film, but I think his understudy or somebody who worked with Johan Johansson actually completed the score, which is kind of cool. But yeah, it is an interesting thing that like the masters that made the first ones aren't really continuing with the second ones.
I think this trailer made me realize. Oh, go ahead.
No, I thought it was funny that the Drago reveal was a surprise, but I mean, we've been writing that story for 6 months.
But not everybody reads the movie news. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I had some people in my newsroom today go like, "Oh, did you know Drago's going to be in the new Rocky movie?"
I actually forgot Drago's going to be the Rocky movie. Yeah, I actually did. I mean, genuinely, when that came up, I was like, "Oh, that's awesome! Who's playing Drago?"
He's a fighter, right? Coming young boxer. Yeah. Okay. They recruited some guy who looks like a monster. I mean, he just looks like you'd never want to be in the same room as the dude.
But he also looks like he'd be Drago's son.
Right. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Dude, who has made better decisions career-wise than Michael B. Jordan? Is that guy do anything wrong?
I mean, Fantastic Four was pretty bad, but
it was bad.
I'll never back as a him.
Yeah, that movie was God, man. I don't know. All four of those actors are great actors. I don't know I know what happened. Well, I know we've heard stories of what happened with Kinberg and Trank, but I mean, whoa, man. Like how did that even get released? It's such a disaster. It really was.
I keep cutting
going,
you
going
off
back to Creed 2. Is it just me or does Sylvester Stallone love writing super personal conversations on a street under a street light? I feel like he really likes having these really powerful conversations under just barely lit, grimy, dark street. I feel like that's his thing.
That works pretty well for him. Yeah.
It does. He's made a career out of it.
Were they saying that spot they were standing in the trailer was the exact spot where Creed died?
Yeah, not Creed. Can't be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I don't understand.
He died in my hands.
Yeah, like
he said, like in this
situation that we're in right now.
It was implied like it was that spot, but it wasn't. I think that fight was in Vegas. I don't remember Rocky IV all that much, but I think the fight was in Vegas.
That's right. Yeah.
I was going to say something about Vegas, and I was going to give away something really big, but I can't. I'm sorry. I'm pulling that back. We're going to jump off Creed. Creed is coming out in November. The other picture that I saw that I definitely want to talk about was Linda Hamilton. First appearance on the set of Terminator 6, and from this instance, I want to turn it over to Kevin because Sarah Connor holds a very special place in his heart.
Yeah, she does.
So we're going through this whole thing with franchises that we love, and characters come back because they have connections to the old films, but it's not always a justified reason to bring them back. I think getting Linda Hamilton to come back for a Terminator movie is exactly what I needed to hear to get me excited for whatever story. And the fact that Tim Miller's directing it, you know, and he did Deadpool has me really excited for it also, but she looks totally badass.
Yeah. Oh, dude. I mean, that news made me very excited. First of all, just seeing her back as the character is unbelievable. I do gotta say, I rewatched T2 recently. I think one of the most bad A moments, in regards to like just sheer awesomeness, is the moment in Terminator 2 where she unlocks herself from the locks and steps out of the room and grabs that nightstick or that broomstick or whatever from the thing, and then just breaks that dude's nose, the guy that just licked her face about like 10 minutes prior. I mean, that scene and just the way she runs down the hallway flipping that thing, she was so awesome. And just the sheer terror of her face on that elevator moment when Arnold steps out. She was incredible in that role. So I think, I'm very excited to see her return. Tim Miller, I love Tim Miller. I think he's a master at visual effects. He was great with the first Deadpool. I'm just hoping that the film still kind of utilizes CG and practical effects. I mean, Stan Winston who did the effects for Terminator 2 Judgment Day. It was so much of it was practical. I mean, it was the beginning. CGI was kind of at the forefront of that point, and the things that were CGI needed to be CGI, but also Arnold, man, Arnold's like this, the skeleton of the actual machine. I mean, that stuff was real, man. Like the, right. as he got more and more, God, I still find it hard to watch Arnold just get destroyed at the end of T2. Just like that whole fight sequence with, you know, the thumbs up, but the whole fight scene with him and Robert Patrick as his arm gets crushed in that machine, and then he's halfway falling over and he pulls the thing out of his stomach. And it's just like, I hope they bring back that, because it centered it, it grounded it, it gave it a reality. I just hope it's not all CG.
You know what's most amazing about T2? What blows my mind the most about that is that it might be the only sequel I can think of that reverses everything that worked about the original and yet still worked. It makes the ruthless Terminator into the caretaker. It takes the meek woman who's being pursued for the whole time and turns her into the badass hunter. Like, it just flips its own script and tells a different story. Whereas in so many other sequels, it's just like, we're going to have the people come back and do the exact same thing, but bigger and faster and louder and in a different location. And I think it's great that Cameron had that. So I'm intrigued too, because Cameron is involved. Like, he claims he has a story for this, and it's like the closest we're going to get to non-Avatar Cameron, I guess, to see this movie come together.
Honestly,
Cameron's involvement does nothing for me.
Yeah.
Every really? Time a Terminator movie comes out, he claims it's the best one since T2, and then everyone hates it, and then he jumps on the hate wagon. It's like, but you said that it was the best one since T2. Like, he,
right.
honestly, like, he's a little bit of a boy that cried wolf, whatever, except it's the boy that cried, this Terminator is good.
Yeah, I kept, and again, I know we're not reviewing Sicario yet, but did you see the thing that came out with Denise raving about Sicario?
No.
Like, it felt similar to the way that Cameron talked about Terminator, even though, because, you know, he didn't direct these other films, and neither did Denise. So I'm just curious, we'll review Sicario, but I thought that was interesting that Denis came out publicly and gave a review of the movie. It just reminded me of James Cameron coming out and talking about Terminator. That's all.
Did I remember we were on the
because of Blade Runner. Was it Blade Runner that kept him from doing Soldado?
I don't know, but Soldado was shot in like 2016, I think.
Okay.
I mean, I don't quote me on that, but I think it started filming in like August of like 2016 or something like that, and then I think
that's probably around the time that Blade Runner would have started filming.
Because Brolin's a little heavier in this film than he is now, obviously. I mean, not that he's heavy, but he's heavier than he is in Deadpool 2 and, Avengers Infinity War. I think he shot Infinity War right after Sicario wrapped. So he told a story the other day on a talk show where Sicario 2 wrapped, him and Del Toro were getting ready to leave, and Del Toro said, yeah, I'm headed to Atlanta to shoot a movie. And Brolin was like, me too. He goes, what are you shooting? He goes, oh, I'm shooting a movie, Infinity War. He goes, oh, me too. And then I guess they were on set together. And then they had that one scene, which I think is a Snatch reference. But by the way, neither of those actors knew it was a Snatch reference. And I'm like, am I wrong about that? Or did I think
that means it's not a Snatch reference.
Yeah, I do. Honestly, I never really super thought it was. I felt like you were seeing something there that wasn't there.
Then let me ask you a question. So if Benicio del Toro says, where is the stone in Snatch as Frankie Fourfingers, and Brolin is holding Del Toro saying, where is the stone? How is that not a Snatch reference?
I think it's the same coincidence. Line.
I don't think that's a coincidence. Dude. There's no way.
If the actors are telling you that they didn't know it, then it's a coincidence.
I've had plenty of actors tell me they had no. I had actors on Ready Player One tell me that they didn't know that this scene in Ready Player One was a Terminator 2 reference when they were filming.
Well, okay, but that's
a big
more
deal.
That's more ignorance than anything else. That's just her not getting it. That's not a movie.
Not
yeah, that, and so, that's not a movie that actor was in.
Del Toro told me that he thought it was a Rolling Stone reference, but that's not a Rolling Stone reference. Where's the stone? So I think that there was never any communication. I think the writers wrote that in there because it's funny that he's holding up the guy who says "Where's the stone" from freaking Snatch, and he's saying that.
Is something like a super well. I mean, is that like a well known line that you can walk out into the street? Take yourself out of it.
I'd argue
the average moviegoer, and I'd say no, that's not a well-known.
But the average moviegoer didn't also know what this was when they saw it in Ready Player One.
That's a much more prevalent pop culture image.
Is the thumbs up pop culture image? I don't think the
thumbs up from T2. I mean, compared to this line from Snatch. More people probably know the reference of the thumbs up than have seen Snatch.
Oh, I'm sure, but I don't think this is a pop culture reference. I think so. I don't think it's big enough to be that. But
we asked Del Toro something, and I'm going to reveal what he said, and I want to get your opinions on it. I want to let people know this is a spoiler. This is an Infinity War spoiler, potentially. So if you're listening on the Facebook page, go away for 5 minutes. If you're listening, Then come back, yes. We asked Del Toro, okay, we're going to do it now, whether the collector's actually dead or not. Or whether the collector being dead was just part of Thanos messing with the Reality Stone.
He wasn't even there.
And he thought that's what I'm saying. Like he Del Toro thought it out, and he said, I think he's still alive. And we were like, why do you think that? And he was really quiet, and he goes, I don't know, I just think he's still alive. And then he kind of couched
in that scene.
He was in that scene. The collector's scene.
No, he's in the scene, but I don't think he was ever there. I think it was all a magical illusion to lure them in. That's all that was.
But they show his lair destroyed, so I guess you could assume he just dies when his lair gets destroyed. But Del Toro
or he left before it was destroyed.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe he wasn't there.
Yeah. I don't think he was actually there in the time frame of that moment. I think that was all an illusion, whatever stone that was. Let them see that the collector. That's why he waves goodbye. I don't think he was actually in the moment. I think it was
that
all
wave goodbye is crazy.
And isn't his character the brother of Goldblum's grandmaster from?
Yes.
I don't think Feige says that without the plan of us getting a scene with those two together.
Yeah, I know.
Is there anyone at Cinema Blend or anywhere that has contact information with the writers of Avengers Infinity War that can
somehow...
They just
did a podcast with Mark Bernardin and Kevin Smith. They just did Fat Man on Batman.
I would love to get them on this.
Yeah. They're cool McFeely. Guys.
They're geniuses. If someone
knows, I'd like to know if I'm just imagining that's a
the
Snatch
reference.
I mean...
I would love for you to be right and love for you to have like told Benicio Del Toro something that he didn't know. But I just think that's just a really interesting coincidence.
In my defense, if I ever get them, I will ask them this.
When I said it to Del Toro, I said, I worded it as, was that, I said, did you know it was a Snatch reference or was it even a Snatch reference? So I still asked him as if we're not 100% sure if it was or not, but I'm almost 99. I told the Russos that I loved the Snatch reference and they laughed. So I think it has to be.
Do you think they laughed and then got back together and went, "What Snatch reference?"
I mean, it's possible. I can't imagine. It's too much of a coincidence. It's the exact same line. It's literally.
I need to see it.
Okay.
I don't know the line. I don't know it.
Snatch.
See, and that's my point. If it's not that big of a line,
dude,
then.
But at the same time, if somebody gave me the thumbs up, I might go with 5 other references before I got to T2.
Yeah, but,
In
Ready Player One, you knew exactly what that reference was.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Okay.
Totally.
In the context of that.
Yeah. The aliens reference in Infinity War.
Yeah.
I don't think that's big enough a moment for people to reference that exact thing that Tom Holland did when they blew out that guy out of the spacecraft.
But he says
aliens. He explains it. I know. What I'm saying is that moment big enough to reference like that? That's all I'm saying.
I don't think that moment is big enough to reference it. I think you have to reference it to let people know that you're actually doing it.
In my eyes, if he hadn't directly said aliens and they had done that, I would have thought, oh, cool, that's like a tip of the cap to aliens.
Oh, yeah. I never would have made that connection. I've seen aliens 5-6 times in my lifetime, but that scene does not have enough resonance in my filmography mindset
If we're being honest and we're talking about like a alien being blown out, I think of Alien before I think of Aliens.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think that, I don't know, I think it's interesting. I think the Snatch reference isn't as deep a cut in regards to other references that are found in that movie. I think Dude, okay, wait a second. One more thing.
Can you guys guess how many minutes ago Gabe told us to move on?
Oh, Gabe's here?
One more question. One more question. The Arrested Development moment. I bet you more people got the Snatch reference than they got the Arrested Development joke. That's
oh,
way
I don't even know
inside.
About. Oh, the
way too inside base.
The Blue Man Group guy. No. The Blue Man Group guy in the tank.
No,
it's David.
I don't think anyone.
There have been articles written about the Arrested Development moment. You're the only person I know talking about the Snatch line.
Somebody reach out to those writers. Are they on Twitter?
Okay. We'll find them. All right, okay. Let's move on to Incredibles 2. So
actually, let's go back to that topic for a second.
Last week.
Let me put on Snatch. Hold on.
You go find it, and we'll talk about the fact that Incredibles 2 dominated at the box office. I mean, anyone who even had a extremely positive prediction of how this was going to do could not have guessed that this movie would make $180 million over its opening weekend.
I would say it did Star Wars numbers, but... No, it didn't do Star Wars.
Dude, do you think... Okay, how sad is Ron Howard to see that movie perform? Is he sad?
Is there anything sadder than the image of a sad Ron Howard? Like, as America, have we failed as a country that we let down Ron Howard? Opie is sad, and he's sad because of us, and it's our fault.
We disappointed him. Yes, I agree. And so let me... Before we get into spoilers, before we discuss... the movie in depth, because you guys both said Jake, you saw it after the fact. I definitely want to get your opinion on it. Why? What's the main reason that you guys think that this movie did as well as it did?
No idea. I mean, first of all, the fact that movie made $180 million baffles me. And the movie's great, but it made $110 million more than the first one did in the opening weekend domestically. Which is insane. I think the first one did $70 million, or whatever it was. But again, ticket prices were lower. No 3D, probably, whatever. But, man, I honestly could not tell you why it did that well. Because I did not feel that type of buzz going into the weekend.
So, I have a question for you. Because when someone tells me that, like, people our age want to go see Toy Story. Right. Like, I understand that nostalgic factor because I was a part of that nostalgic factor. Like, I remember... seeing Toy Story when I was 7. And so when Toy Story 3 came out, I felt like as a kid that grew up in the way that Andy did, I needed to be there. I didn't feel the nostalgia for The Incredibles because I didn't necessarily feel like I grew up with it. Like, I remember where I went and saw it in theaters. I remember where I was when I saw it. But is there a generation, maybe a few years younger than us, that feels for The Incredibles the way that we felt for Toy Story? And could that be a factor that we're discounting the nostalgia of The Incredibles?
I'll say this. I posted my
fiance is screaming yes on the other side of the condo.
I posted my Incredibles ticket for the first movie on my Instagram, and I'm not gonna lie, there were a lot of people who commented, "I can't wait to see this." I'm like, really? I knew the movie was gonna be big, and I knew it was gonna be a Pixar film. I thought it maybe it would maybe make $100 million opening weekend, maybe 90. I have no idea, but 180. I could never have guessed that. I'm shocked.
I'll tell you one thing. Well, there's two reasons. To speak to quickly to the nostalgia that you're talking about, Jake, as a parent of two boys who are 14 and 10, the Pixar library is the babysitter that you've had, right? Like for us growing up, the films that we watched over and over again, or television shows that we watched, anytime we took a car trip, just the Pixar movies came with us. Our boys had DVD players. They brought all the Pixar movies with them, which is why I think Finding Dory did as well as it did, because they just grew up on Nemo. And they just wanted to. They didn't really care what it was. It did, but Dory Dory got to $1 billion. Toy Story 3 and Dory are the two Pixar movies that crossed $1 billion. So I just think the nostalgia of being a Pixar movie, but also there's no family movies out there right now. The last animated movie in theaters was Sherlock Gnomes, which nobody went to. And for May, you had Infinity War, which is pretty dark, Deadpool 2, and then Solo, which didn't light any fires. Families have been chomping at the bit to be able to go see something together, you know, as a group of 4 and 5 people. That's a good point. I just think that helped to crush. But also the other thing that we keep been talking about is like it's the flip side of a Star Wars movie every 6 months. This is 14 years people were waiting to see more of these characters, and it wasn't, the characters don't age. You know, as long as you have the voices, you can just continue the story from wherever you want to go.
When you talk about, like, these characters don't age, remember when Dumb and Dumber 2 came out, T-O-O, it was a little bit of a, like, one, it way past the point of when it should have come out by now, but there's also an element of, like, seeing those two guys just kind of old, and you're like, oh, like...
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, like it's a bummer to see them. That's right. Like these, like, I don't want to see those characters old. Like, right. I want to remember them as they were. And you're right. I think it was smart not to age the characters.
Yes.
It's kind of like Lisa Simpson in The Simpsons, right? Like how she never ages. That, did you already make that reference?
Or any of The Simpsons. No. They don't age any of The Simpsons.
But wasn't there like an episode where they get older?
Yeah, it shows all of them.
Okay.
And it's kind of depressing because, like, Bart's kind of like a loser later in life. And
yeah. Sam Jackson said this takes place 2 days later after the first event, Incredibles.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. All right. So let's get into spoilers then. Let's start talking about the movie in depth. And then I have a question that I want to ask you guys. So, Gabe, please put the spoiler banner up on the Facebook feed. We are going to get into spoilers for Infinity War, Incredibles 2, and talk about... Okay, so let's start there. The decision to pick up immediately after where the first one left off, I think was a brilliant, brilliant place to begin your sequel, because I wanted to see the Underminer. I wanted to see another adversary of this Incredibles team. We got a hint at Bon Voyage, which I thought was a pretty funny joke from the first movie. But then, you know, Syndrome was a new villain. So I loved the fact that they brought Ratzenberger back to voice the Underminer, and I thought it was a really good way to sort of kick off with a great action set piece. Yep. The monorail bit with Frozone was really good, and the drill going through the city and the family working together was terrific. I thought that was a really, really good way for them to start. And the movie never really
slowed down. In the same way that you could watch Rogue One and A New Hope together, you could kind of just watch Incredibles and Incredibles 2 together. You can kind of just walk back to back.
Totally. What did you guys think about the shift to put Elastigirl front and center and the keeping Mr. Incredible at home? Did you like that role reversal?
I love that. I thought that was very clever. I thought that it could just signify the importance of parents and the different duties that different parents do. And I think that it was fascinating to watch. I mean, a lot of the best moments in the film are with Mr. Incredible and Jack-Jack, and then I still can't believe that Edna is voiced by Brad Bird. That blows my mind. I don't understand. Has anybody ever seen him do it in person? Is there video of Brad Bird doing that voice? Because I just don't know where that comes from.
I saw him do it. Actually, I saw him do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
He did a press conference at Pixar, and he drops into other voices frequently.
Like, it's amazing.
Pixar executives weird voices, and he'll be like, and then they said to me, you gotta go back and make more money, there's money on the table. Like, he goes into these really weird voices all the time.
The kid who voices Jack-Jack, I think he's 14 now. I think he was a baby when from what I understand, it was a production person's baby that was born around that
one
time
of the
or whatever,
lead
right?
animators, yes.
And I would assume they just reused, because he's still credited. That guy, Eli something, is still credited as Jack-Jack in Incredibles 2.
That's
clearly
awesome.
his voice is probably much deeper now.
I would hope so.
But but it is fascinating to think about the idea that they kind of maybe reuse the baby voice. And because Jack-Jack is a huge part of this movie. And maybe they just have an archive of sounds of the baby just making these like goofy sounds and excited sounds and crying sounds and things like that. But... I was so fascinated by the role reversal. I thought, I think one of the things that I love about Brad Bird is that he directs this film very much like he would direct a live action movie. And I think the action, photography and everything about the way the action was set felt real. And oddly enough, in the middle of an animated movie, it felt like it was really happening, even though it was ridiculous and over the top with Elastigirl splitting herself in that tunnel sequence. But I was very fascinated by how this film was shot, quote unquote. It was very well done. So and Burt was even saying he messed with the shutter speed of the camera, which is kind of crazy to think about. So I was very impressed with it.
One of the best looking shots is the one that caused some controversy afterwards, with people having to get the epilepsy warning. The fight against the villain with with Elastigirl looked amazing. That looked so cool. It had like a noir sort of tint to it. It was the first time I saw that, like, the animation style almost shift to fit that scene in particular. Yeah. I thought that looked really... So Brad Bird also said, like, this is the first time... We went back and revisited the first one. The animation looks really clunky. It is. It's 2003 or 2004. I forget when it came out. 2004. And he said they finally look like he envisioned them in his brain. Like, the characters finally look like he was able to make them look the way that they looked. And I thought that really came together with Elastigirl's cycle and that chase with the monorail and all that stuff. That stuff was great. Brad Bird is amazing at setting up action set pieces.
I thought Odenkirk killed it. Like, Odenkirk was so perfect as that character. And I love the way he moved, the way he talked, his energy. I just thought that was a very cool addition to the Incredibles universe. Like, I loved the whole dynamic with him and Catherine Keener. I thought they were great. It was great. And it's weird because I think Odenkirk is the only one to me that sounds like he looks. Everyone else looks different. Yeah. Like Craig T. Nelson, I can't get my mind around it. It looks nothing like Craig T. Nelson. I can't imagine Craig T. Nelson voicing that character. It's very strange to me. And same with Holly Hunter and same with Keener. Those three just kind of... They look so much different than their characters. They feel so much different. But Odenkirk was just, it was him, man. It just looked like him. So I thought that was fascinating. Like Craig T. Nelson, that still blows my mind that that's him. It really does.
You know, I think that the best compliment I can give sort of the Incredibles films is, and not a knock to the action, because obviously the action is incredible, but it's maybe the only superhero movies that when they're in an action sequence, I want them to get back to the normal life because... Yeah. I think that those scenes are so, you know, we also just rewatched the first Incredibles. I mean, and people forget, like, it goes to, I don't want to say, like, serious dark places, but there's a moment where she thinks he's having an affair. And there's a moment where, like, he's entering kind of what you'd argue is, like, borderline depression because he can't be a superhero. And that's very reflective of, like, what happens to a lot, you know, kids that peak in high school and then have to go live a normal life. People that have to work these everyday jobs and they don't get to be the wild and crazy person Though that very much would happen in the same way that I'm actually a really big fan of Zack Snyder's Watchmen, this idea of, well, what, you know, who watches the Watchmen, you know, what happens when the superheroes start being bad people. I love this idea of like when they take off their capes, no capes, when they take off their costumes,
right,
they've got to be normal people and they still have to wash dishes and they still have to do laundry and they still have to have kids. And I think that that's fascinating. And I think it's great that I love those scenes just as much, if not more so, than the action sequences.
Well, that's why the best scenes in that film, to your point, are the Mr. Incredible moments with the kids. Like, I thought the whole math thing was hilarious. I thought, and I don't even have kids, and I got that joke, because everything, I mean, you have kids, Sean. I feel like things are always changing. Like I already learned math. How is this different?
Math is math.
Right. So I just think that those moments, like Jake said, they're that's why the movie's so great, is because... To me, they're both on equal playing fields. The action is as good as every other scene. Every scene is great. And the action serves a purpose and tells the story and moves the story forward. And everything means something. And it's not just action for action's sake. So I think that...
I don't know if it was the biggest laugh in our screening, and I might have been the only one that laughed when it happened, but when Mr. Incredible puts Jack back in his crib after he gets out a couple of times and puts the table on top of it, I laughed so loud because felt that.
See, I didn't get that joke.
Okay, what as a parent, Sean, as the only one that's a parent in this conversation,
right?
Are you pulling things from this movie that one day, if Kevin and I end up, you know, maybe having kids one day, that we're gonna look back on it and go, oh, I didn't even realize how funny that was.
Oh,
until now,
totally, 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's just that idea of reading a story to the kid and feeling the kid fall asleep with each line passing is like one step closer to a little bit of freedom. And you're just like, once I get this kid to go to sleep, I can get like a little bit of me time. And then you turn around and then like they're awake for whatever reason. Like it just never happens. I've said this before. This was how movies change completely. And it was a Pixar one. I saw the first Finding Nemo and I thought it was technically great. But it didn't wow me the way the Toy Story movies did. I saw it first in the theater, and we were just a couple. We were married, Michelle and I. And then when it came out on DVD months later, we had found out in that interim we were going to have a kid, that we were going to have PJ. And I watched it a second time knowing I was going to have a kid, and it was a totally different movie. It was just... It just totally changed. It completely changed. So, I mean, yeah, the same movie, different audience member.
I think that the, we're burying the lead here because the best moment in Incredibles 2 is the Snatch reference. When they say, "Where is the stone?" And I was just like, wow. Like the beauty of that reference, with Brad Bird's reference, is that it was it was like an Inception layer deep cut. It was like, it was referencing Infinity War, but it was also referencing Snatch. So if Infinity War was referencing,
I quit this podcast. I really do. I'm done.
Is it all a lie?
I miss Kevin talking about Dunkirk. Can we go back to Dunkirk?
Do you know what made me so sad? We were at Pixar, and our friend Juan, who's been a guest on this show, said, well, you know that Catherine Keener's character is the villain. And I was like, no, what are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, her name is Evelyn Dever, which if you say it slowly is Evil Endeavor. And I was like, oh, yeah.
I didn't even catch on to that.
I know. It made me so mad when he said it. I was like, you jerk. You just ruined a whole movie for us.
That was a good twist,
4 months
actually.
Away from it happening.
I thought Odenkirk was going to be the villain. Actually, that threw me. Actually, that was very good writing, I thought. I knew one of them was going to be the villain, but I was more leaning towards Odenkirk. But I guess now looking back on it, I got to look back on how isolated Keener's character was throughout the film. Kind of doing her own
thing. I
kind
of like it wasn't both of them, too. I kind of like that it was one, and the other one was actually trying to do something with the heroes, too.
Yeah, and Sam...
Yeah, it's like that great Roger Ebert line he wrote one time, and I can't remember what he was referencing, but it's a pretty good rule, which is that, like, big A-list actors don't sign on for characters that don't matter.
Yeah,
and true. Anytime you ever see, like, you know, an Oscar winner, and, like, this... You know, I always think of, like, Redford in Civil War... Or not Civil War, Winter Soldier. You know, like, he's not going to take just that, like, the second that I saw him in that movie, I was like, well, he's going to end up being the bad guy, because even though it's, like, this small secondary tertiary character, I was like, he's not going to sign on for a role that doesn't have a little meat at the end. So that was my first thought, was like, well, neither of these people, but to your point, yeah, I'm surprised that it was one and not the other.
So, in Winter Soldier, another great, like, kind of, like, very small reference, when he opens the refrigerator, and the Newman's Own salad dressing is in the refrigerator, right? So that's a very small reference, but it works. I mean, I didn't catch it the second or third time I saw it until someone pointed it out to me. They were like,
"Was that in Sundance?"
To Bush and Sundance as well.
Bush and Sundance reunion.
But I thought that was I'm telling you, references happen. Like they're little and they're minuscule. And that particular one with Redford was so great. I remember I was interviewing Redford for that Pete's Dragon film, and I was like, I tweeted out, like, I'm interviewing Redford, and someone tweeted me saying, oh my god, you gotta bring up the Newman's Own, and I was like, what the heck are you talking about? So then I went back and watched, and I found it, and that's what it was. I mean, the Russos put Newman's Own salad dressing in the refrigerator when he opened it, and it's just a brief shot, and that was a reference to Paul Newman. That was it.
Here's my big question to you guys. Do they do Incredibles 3, and should they wait to create anticipation?
They should wait 28 years this time, and then it takes place the second Incredibles 2 ended. The second.
You better record Craig
T. Or the entire or that 2 minute gap. What happened in that 2 minute gap between 1 and 2? That's what I want to say.
Yeah. The 2 day gap between 1 and 2, as Jake said, we go back and we fill that in. That's
give the perfect people what they want.
And then we're going to do spin-off scenes. We're going to do a spin-off of the boyfriend who liked the daughter of Mr. Incredible. We're going to get his story. So we're going to go back and we're going to find out why he's called Solo.
I guess no real answers from you guys today.
Yeah.
We'll move on. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom is opening this week, and we will review it in depth next week because there's a lot of stuff that I want to talk about.
Johnny Depp.
But for now, let's go spoiler-free reactions, and we can start with Jake, because I don't even think I know. Oh, and also, yeah, I mentioned that we were going to try to do a ranking of the second best Jurassic movie, and Gabe convinced me to do that next week, when we can actually talk in depth about Fallen Kingdom and where it might fit in a rank. So, real quick review of Fallen Kingdom. Just would you recommend it, and maybe why, and stuff like that.
I would say that it's Fallen Kingdom is two movies that are stitched together, and one of them I think is really fun and really enjoyable, and the other one I think is complete and total crap. I really dug the first half of this movie, the volcano rescue sequence. Once it gets into the mustache twirling villains who are auctioning off dinosaurs for a ridiculously low price, like $4 million for a dinosaur seems kind of low. It just gets really silly for me.
Not that interesting dinosaurs went for $4 million.
Yeah,
like, this guy has an armored
shell. $4 million for a dinosaur? Yeah. Like if I can take out a loan and buy a dinosaur, I feel like that's a little low. I just got really stupid once. I mean, and what's sad is that like the part that I think is stupid is probably the direction that the franchise is going, and that's what worries me. Is that what I think is stupid is probably the future.
Scale back on details, save that for next week.
But in terms of like should people see it, that's a tough question because like in terms of like the literal usage of the word see, I do think it's worth seeing because I think it is the most beautiful Jurassic Park movie.
Okay. Beautifully shot, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah. Kevin, before you go, I just want to say that Jake and I are on the complete opposite end. Like the first half of with the volcano, I'd found to be really bad. Like
interesting.
I'm not saying that I liked the second half much better, but I thought that that whole plot either, without, again, getting into too much detail, they either needed to make that story of the rescue, the volcano rescue, the entire movie, and give it some room to breathe, or come up with a different way to get back to the island. See, the problem with these movies is that they always need a reason to go to the island, and I just didn't like the reason. I didn't like this movie's reason for going back.
Oh, I like
rescue for Blue because of a volcano. It never hooked me.
Oh, I thought that was cool. I actually thought that was a really good reason to go to the island. I like this film. I don't love this film. It is a massive step up from Jurassic World. I mean, it's not even close in my opinion in regards to quality. Jurassic World was just, I mean, it was fine, but it was just too much CGI. And there is CGI in this film, obviously. There has to be.
I would argue that the problems that people have with Jurassic World are what I have with this movie. That it's just CGI. It's like nonstop. Oh,
no. This film was way more practical than Jurassic World. I mean, there are literal scenes that happen with practical dinosaurs that are massive moments in the movie. There's one in the trailer with the T-Rex when they're in the back of that truck, that's fully practical. I mean, I'm sure it becomes CGI when it opens its mouth and it starts to bite Pratt. But I think the beauty of this movie is that it's hard to tell sometimes, in my opinion, what's CGI and what's not. There's a great,
I disagree, dude. I can't talk about specifics, but I totally disagree.
There's
I think
a moment.
There was a point where it was like just overkill. I was waving the white flag.
I think towards the end, in the third act of the film, without giving anything away, there's more CGI. Clearly, like there's a shot, for example. All right, I don't know if anybody's watched my interviews yet. If you have, then you already can answer this question. But the scene when the fingers are crawling towards the bed, right, with the little girl in the bed, right? Mm-hmm. You know the shot I'm talking about, like when it's
in the trailer.
All right, mm-hmm. Is that CGI or practical?
I would assume practical.
Jake?
Yeah, I'd say probably practical. It would be smart to make it practical.
CGI. So, I mean, like, that to me is a great example of a moment that because your brain has been given a lot of animatronics in that film and given moments of real-life human touching these quote-unquote animals, that I think your brain was computing things as animatronics and real feeling. And I think that there are CGI. There is a lot of CGI in this film, clearly. But I'm telling you right now, I think that this film is a return to what Spielberg brought to the table in 93. And I'm not saying it's anywhere near as a masterpiece as what Spielberg created in 93, but there's something to be said about a actor with an animatronic dinosaur and the emotion you feel in that moment. And this movie delivers that. While the second half of the film, I think, is weaker than the first half, I still don't hate the second half like Jake does. But I think it works. I actually very much enjoyed this movie.
But I think you're talking more technicality. And technicality is, I think, technically is what keeps Jurassic Park still relevant 25 years. But what keeps it great is an amazing story. And that's what I think Fallen Kingdom lacks. I mean, I think maybe because they use more animatronics that Fallen Kingdom will still hold up a little bit better than the other Jurassic World in 10, 15 years. But that's not going to change the fact that in 10, 15 years, I'm still going to have problems with the story.
It's not that I don't think Fallen Kingdom is a great movie. I think it's a pretty good film that I think is worth seeing in a theater. And I think that it, to me, in a time of CGI, it returns to that practical nature. And see, like, I understand what you're saying, but I think that technically aside, when you're in a moment with an actor in a practical dinosaur, you are more immersed in that scene. And there are two or three key scenes, in my opinion, that the actors are dealing with actual emotion with a practical dinosaur, a couple different ones, that feels unbelievably real. And I think
we can talk about one of them's in the trailer. We can talk about the one in the trailer, T-Rex. Which is the T-Rex.
Right.
When the T-Rex is sleeping.
I think that's one of the best scenes in the movie.
But the scene before that, without giving anything
because
away.
Because it's tense.
The reason why they go to the T-Rex. So the scene prior to that, if you can remember it. Practical effects as well. There's something to be said about that. And then don't forget the gyrosphere one shot in the first act. It's in the trailer. You see Chris Pratt swimming and you see Bryce Dallas Howard and Justice in that gyrosphere. I mean, Bayona, like, there is some filmmaking in this movie that blew my mind. And I think that there is immersion in this film that is going to be looked over because the story may not be as great as Jurassic Park. But this is hands down the best film since the first Jurassic Park.
Let me go fast.
We gotta keep Lost World. You know that, right? He hates it. We gotta wrap it up.
I love Bayona. I have a Monsters Call poster hanging up on the wall. I love The Impossible. I love The Orphanage. I love his films, and I think this is his first bad film. I think it's bad. I'm actually to the point where I don't think I can recommend people go see it I thought about it, the more I was disappointed by it.
Jake, what's your rating? Out of five.
Out of five, 2.5.
That's where I'm at, too.
Are you recommending it or not?
I'm saying that it's visually beautiful, so if you want to see it for, like, the dinosaurs, yeah. People know what they want to see it for. If you want to just go see frenetic dinosaur action, then that's exactly what you're going to get, and you know what you're paying for. But if you're going looking for a return to Jurassic form, that's not what you're going to get.
I wish there was footage of Jake and I watching this film, because I think him and I are more on the same playing field than we think we are. I just like the film more than he did.
Keep in mind, like, I will fully admit, in that first half, I looked over to you and was like, dude, this movie's awesome.
Yeah.
But then the second half started.
Right.
And I hate the second half more than I like the first half.
But I don't hate the second half. So I really actively
hate the second half.
Okay.
Okay. Right. We'll talk about why next week. We'll get into some specifics for sure, because
is like two movies kind of stitched together.
Oh yeah,
It's part one and then part two.
Yes,
I like that though. I like the different tones. It's a horror film. I've heard that also. Yeah.
Okay. We will review Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom with spoilers next week. So everybody go see it this weekend, or don't if you want to listen to me. And we will come back and talk about where we think the franchise is going, because it has a pretty major cliffhanger.
Yeah, and there's for people that are going to go see it this weekend, stay through the credits. There's an after credit scene.
Last question before we move on. Do both of you think it's better than Trevorrow's film?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
Nope.
I do not. I think Trevorrow's film, I'll say this and then leave it at that just to tick off Sean for a week. I think Trevorrow's film is the worst Jurassic movie.
No, that is not true.
I would actually agree with you. I actually agree with you 100% on that.
Jurassic World, and actually, I just rewatched.
Okay,
all
so
of
now
them.
Don't wave me off.
Open the floodgates.
Jurassic World is actually my choice for the number two best movie in the franchise.
Well, you're insane, man.
Jurassic World.
That is absolute insanity.
World. It's great. It actually has a legit reason to go back to the island. And
Dave's getting mad.
The right. set pieces are great. They're really good. Okay, we got to move. We got to do Zemeckis.
One question.
Because also I want to save this for next week, because I want to go deep dive next week.
Can I ask one question? Just one question. Sean.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Answer this.
Yes.
Better movie.
Yeah.
Jurassic World or Forrest Gump?
Jurassic World.
Dude.
Jurassic World. And that's not even close.
That's absolute insanity.
On that note, we will talk about Zemeckis Blend, this week's hashtag blend game, because we're doing... We picked Zemeckis Blend kind of out of the blue. I just thought he was a filmmaker that we should be talking about. He makes a lot of summer blockbuster-esque films, and then one of his trailers drops today on the day that we're doing this. Welcome to Marwan, which is going to be a fictionalized or dramatic version of a documentary with Steve Carell playing this character who gets beaten by Nazis, an artist who gets knocked over the head and loses his ability to communicate via written word and uses dolls to tell stories. And so this trailer dropped. I watched it. It's really weird. Did you guys think it was intriguing? Did it hook your interest? What? It looked really unusual.
I really
think Steve Carell is one of the most underappreciated, exciting actors out there. I mean, right. Like, we're talking about a guy that, I mean, I feel like it took a while for us to really kind of start getting maybe like a serious Robin Williams. Remember, like, for the longest time, like, I mean, every once in a while he would pop into a serious role, but you know, overall he did just comedy for so many years. And I feel like Steve Carell's just got this really awesome career of doing The Office and then doing the animated work and then doing something like A Foxcatcher and then something turning around and doing something like Date Night and Dinner for Schmucks. And now he's doing this
he's
film.
He's had a great career.
He's got a great career making fantastic choices and showing a lot more range than I think he gets credit for.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
I just wish Foxcatcher was a better movie. Ugh.
No, I agree. I like Foxcatcher a lot. No. It's really dark. Okay, yeah. So Zemeckis. We did. We debated the best Zemeckis film, and in a total lack of suspense, all three of us picked the same movie. So, Kevin, please tell us why Back to the Future is the best movie that Robert Zemeckis has ever directed.
So I actually was debating between Back to the Future Part 1 and Forrest Gump, and I think I went Back to the Future.
Thank you.
Well, Forrest Gump was actually very close because of the technical achievements he made in that film and the storytelling and the scope of that story. But Back to the Future, to me, just... I'm going to put rewatchability at the top of my list here of just why this film is
the best movie ever made. Which should be a factor. I agree. That should be a factor.
I just think that this film, to make a film that's timeless, is very hard. And I don't think that you start out saying, okay, I want to make a movie that's going to be good in 30 years. But the art that went into that film, storytelling-wise, filmmaking-wise, the effects that they used in that movie with what they had at that time, the whole idea of necessity is the mother of invention, that whole concept, there was time put into that movie. There was so much work put into that film. So much so that it still baffles my mind that it was made when it was made. And I think that the story, the characters, I love part two so much. I love part three. I think that's one of the best trilogies ever made. And I think the through line being Zemeckis, clearly. But Zemeckis was way ahead of his time with everything he's ever made. I mean, Back to the Future, Forrest Gump with JFK shaking Tom Hanks' hand. I mean, Polar Express, that was like the forefront, in my opinion, of performance capture and motion capture technology. This guy doesn't get enough credit for the technology he's created and brought to the big screen.
It's Cameron-esque in terms of 3D.
Yeah, Cameron kind of gets that credit, right? But I think I always kind of look at Zemeckis and Polar Express and the utilization of what he was doing with special effects back then. But Back to the Future, just everything about it moves. Silvestri's score, everything is perfect. I mean, it's a perfect movie. It genuinely is, and there's nothing wrong with it. And it will still be good in 30 years. And I watch it today, and it still looks amazing. So... That is, and we need to do Cameron Blend one day because I feel like we all would. I don't know if we'll agree on that one, but
I thought about that.
I think that Back to the Future, no question, it's timeless, rewatchable, it's perfect. The score is great, performances are great. Michael J. Fox is perfect, Christopher Lloyd's perfect. Everyone's great. It's a great movie.
Jake,
And it's also, you know, when you think about the actual story itself, it's both an incredibly simple, like really sweet story, but then also this incredibly complicated story too. It's weird because I wanted to sort of kind of come at the angle of like, well, what kind of story is it? And I find situations where it's both complicated and simple at the same time. And you're absolutely right. I feel like the reason I appreciate Zemeckis's form of utilizing special effects is because oftentimes I don't realize they are special effects, which to me, that's what the best special effects are. When you look back and you go, oh, by the way, did you know that that was effects? And you go, wait, what? As opposed to you watch a Cameron movie and you 9 times out of 10, you're going to know that that's a special effect. And I'm not knocking his usage of special effects because obviously it's groundbreaking, but Zemeckis uses it to, as a tool to kind of push the story forward because it is a necessity. For me personally, a comfort. This Back to the Future just is the cinematic equivalent of a warm blanket being pulled over you on a cold day. And it just feels good. And it's one of those movies, a handful of movies. I'd put it in the same vein of Jurassic Park where, like, if I just want to throw on a movie and just kind of feel good about the world, which these days we need a little bit more often than we used to, that's one of those movies that I'll put on.
Yep.
That's a great point, though, about the blanket thing. It's like, it does feel like that. It feels, you know it's going to make you feel good. That's the thing. It's great.
It's a screenplay, too, that gets studied by all the masters, you know.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. They always go back to that screen. I think we talked to Zach Penn when he was talking about Ready Player One and talked about how much they just went back over the Back to the Future screenplay because it's so airtight. Like, I love any type of ticking clock mechanism, you know, and the idea of hitting the clock tower at the exact same moment to funnel the lightning into the DeLorean is delightful. But what's so delightful about it is that it's teased in the opening scene, you know, like giving him the pamphlet. Like, that's how elaborate the screenplay is that there's no wasted moment and it's all funneling to, it's like big picture, and it's little, funnel it down to the moment that you need it to happen. And I don't care how many times I watch Back to the Future, when he's racing toward the thing, I'm on the edge of my seat like he's not going to get there this time.
Oh, yeah.
And to take it one step further, like, you know when that feeling when you get so tense, and then it works out, but then, like, you're so exhausted that you almost just, like, get teary-eyed and kind of need to breathe?
Yeah.
That sequence, the moment following when the DeLorean disappears and Doc just kind of just runs down the street celebrating, screaming. Yep. Like, I'm both out of breath and teary-eyed in that same moment because it's just like...
Which is why in part two, it's hysterical that they revisit that part and then have another Marty come running down the street.
Yeah.
I love how they intertwine.
I wish 3 got more credit. I really do.
Three's great.
I love 3 so much, and I think...
3 feels like the other one, though. Like, 2 feels like a companion piece to 1, and then there's the other one.
Yeah,
but if you're going the other one route, to me, would apply to Indy 4. Like, I don't think 3 is that much of a departure. It's still, I mean, it's still, I don't know.
But we're talking 2 different franchises. Like, every franchise can have the other one. But it feels like, I mean, I feel like we live in an age where, like, films need a trilogy. But, like, looking at something like It, like, sometimes you only need 2 to tell the story. Sure. Sometimes you don't need that third film. And it feels like, I always feel like the Back to the Future story is kind of done at 2, but they felt the need for a trilogy, so they came up with the idea for the third one.
But I loved experiencing Doc's storyline, like the his romance. I mean, I think 3 arguably has one of the greatest action scenes in the entire franchise with that train sequence. I love the train sequence so much, and I just throwing the hoverboard. And then him going out to get Mary Steenburgen. I just love that moment. And to me, the intensity you're talking about, feeling that, like, anxiety. Every time I watch that scene, are they going to make it? I mean, that scene blows my mind. Like, and then boom, and it just disappears at the end of the train track. It's so well done. And I think I think that movie doesn't get enough credit, in my opinion.
Okay, I have a question for you. We all agree on Back to the Future.
Yes.
What is your number 2 Zemeckis
movie? That's what I was going to ask. Jake! Dang it, I love it. All right, Kevin was going to say, did you say Forrest Gump?
Is that? But Who Framed Roger Rabbit technically, like, is another masterpiece. I mean, God, like the
You said Forrest Gump. You said Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump.
Still count.
Yeah, it is Forrest Gump.
I know Jake's Castaway.
Castaway.
Mine was Castaway.
Oh, I also said Forrest Gump.
Oh, wow.
But I also have a soft spot in my heart for
two
the
Gumps
old,
and
the
a
old
Castaway.
Forrest Gump is masterful storytelling. The scope of that story is insane.
All right, so we got to go. Next week's homework is... I cannot get on board with this. I'm just a staunch believer in the fact that it's a crap film. It's a really bad film. Well, I'll never get on board. I would have gone Romancing the Stone before I went anywhere near.
We mentioned Juan earlier. Our good friend Juan also pointed out Contact, which is a very strong...
Also great.
I actually really forgot good. That was Zemeckis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until Flight, he said
Flight
that.
Is also a great, Flight's also a great piece of work.
Flight Let's also has... acknowledge that, like, Zemeckis it was the type of filmmaker who, I think we mentioned it when we did Tom Hanks, but, like, he paused his production of Castaway, went and shot What Lies Beneath, came back and finished Castaway. Like, that's amazing. He's
The movie of his is the most underrated is The Walk. And The Walk, that movie, just the sheer epicness of that moment of him walking across those towers.
But okay, but that's IMAX like the 3D. Last 40, 45 minutes. Well, like, and the documentary first hour so and better. A half of that movie.
Oh, I agree.
I just have a hard time getting through.
But I will say, cinematically, I've never experienced anything like that in IMAX, in 3D.
I will say, it did give me like that. If you saw it in 70mm IMAX, as I did, I'm sure you guys did too.
Unreal.
You did get that, like, that stomach churning of, like, whenever you look over and you see, like, a really high. And that's impressive. But I just felt like the stuff it took to get there was just not
good. I loved
enough.
It. I love that story.
That story, to me, I think ranks as the best story I've ever heard in my entire life. The story of that guy wire walking between the Twin Towers. Yeah. And what I love most about it is because the towers aren't here with us anymore, he'll be the only person on this planet to say that he did it, and nobody can do it.
I interviewed that guy. I met Philippe Petit.
Did you really?
This was crazy to me because when I was a kid, I went to New York City with my grandparents and my family, and we went to the towers, and the line was too long to get to the top. So my uncle and I sat down in between the two. I can't remember. We looked up, and he told me the story about this guy who tightroped across the towers. It was Philippe Petit, and I was like, I never heard this story before. And then Man on Wire came out, and it blew my mind. Man on Wire was one of the best documentaries of all time. But then I got to meet Philippe Petit for The Walk, and he still has the thing that he used. I held it. Like, I held the thing that he used. It was so surreal. Like, it was so cool to, like, but could you, I mean, seriously, imagine doing that. Like, it's so mind blowing.
Falling to your death. How does he not fall?
But I think Zemeckis captured it so well. I mean, I think that's the closest we'll ever get to being up there.
Did they make that more dramatic than it was? I mean, did they, you know, there are a couple of moments when you watch that movie where, like, you think he's going to fall. I can't remember in the documentary. Like, was it fairly perfect and they kind of made it a little bit more dramatic?
I mean, a little bit. He laid down on the wire in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Like, sat and then laid down.
Just like you just said that. Like, I just got like that weird feeling again.
Dude,
just like thinking
you
about...
and rats is me in Heights. And even just talking about this, my palms are sweating. Like, I can't do this.
I just got that weird stomach turning just thinking about him laying down on that wire.
Yeah. Listeners who played along with Zemeckis Blend, they also went Back to the Future. Clear winner. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, close second. But so many of his movies got mentioned. Forrest Gump got mentioned a bunch, as we said. Juan mentioned Contact. And then it was Andy Erickson commented on Facebook on the live feed today that he hoped that I rewatched Gump to prepare. Well, Andy, I didn't. And I won't. Because I don't want to waste my time. Next week's homework. Yes, sir.
Do you remember the scene in Back to the Future, though, where, like Doc and Marty are having, like,
this is gonna be
I quit this freaking podcast. I'm done.
They're talking about the stone. It's a stone.
I can't do it anymore.
They're discussing the stone. But here's why it's beautiful. It's because it's called Back to the Future. Snatch hadn't even been made yet. But
amazing.
They still referenced it. That's how deep that cut was. Back to the Future came out decades before Snatch. And they still had a Snatch reference in the movie. I mean, it's brilliant. Like,
you joke, but that's more likely than the Snatch reference being in Infinity War.
No, it's not. I'm telling you.
Next week's
someone
homework.
Get the writers on the phone. If I'm wrong, I'm going to be very upset.
I'm afraid next week's homework is going to be too easy for Kevin, but we are going to play hashtag Schwarzenegger Blend.
Oh.
I want to discuss the films of Arnie next week. Again, because I just feel like we're in a summer movie stretch, and I think that we can make a debate that it's not T2. I don't think it's T2 anyway. So Kevin's gonna have a good time with that one.
Okay. So wait, just because I'd argue, Schwarzenegger is on the tougher end of spelling things. Can we make it like chopper blend? Like get to the chopper blend?
I'm an Arnold blend.
Schwarzenegger blend might be tough. Arnold blend.
Arnold blend. All right. We'll do hashtag Arnold blend. So if you're playing along at home, make sure you use that.
Jake's doing Batman and Robin. We all know that. Stay cool.
Everyone chill.
Chill.
All right. Where can listeners find you on social media, Jake Hamilton?
At Jake's Takes.
Okay. Kevin?
Sean. Oh, what's happening? No, I'm being serious. To add to Schwarzenegger next week, can we also ask for his best one-liner? Because I think
that's a good one.
I think we should do his best movie and also his best one-liner.
And we're talking... No, not best movie, best performance.
Best performance.
Yes, best performance.
And then
best
really,
one-liner.
That could really make things very interesting.
That's a
because,
good one.
Because, like, the one-liners in Commando, I mean, they're, I can quote
I'm going to rewatch Commando just for the one-liners.
Is the best.
Let off some steam.
No. When he says, when he breaks the guy's neck, and then he puts his hat over him and calls a stewardess over, and he politely says, "Don't disturb my friend, he's dead tired." And the guy's literally dead. I mean, like, think about the sheer incredible nature of that line. Like, I mean, he just killed
the
guy.
You think when the guy wrote that, whoever wrote that, do you imagine him sitting at his desk and he writes it and just shakes his head and goes, "Oh, classic." You think he like went for a walk after that? You went outside, had a cigarette, and he's like, "Honey, you'll never believe. Pack the bags, we're moving into a mansion. I have struck gold."
But if you think about that, like, he's literally telling the stewardess, "This guy's dead."
He's dead.
She thinks he's just tired.
It's a laugh line. It's a laugh line in the movie. I just killed this guy.
I think, can we just do a podcast where Kevin walks us through and over-explains every Schwarzenegger line as if we don't get it?
Man. All right. Drop us a review.
You have
on
to
iTunes.
Get to the chopper because there's a chopper there that you have to get to.
He
says
the guy
he'll be back.
And he says,
because he will in fact be back.
Those aren't as punny as the ones I'm referring to. Like in Predator, when he stabs a guy into the tree and says, "Stick around." I mean, like, he's joking about murdering somebody. And it's like, and it's funny, but it's actually genius. And
let off some steam, Bennett. He throws a pipe so far through the guy that steam comes through.
Because I think, like, we'll get into Schwarzenegger next week, but Schwarzenegger came around at a time where those were okay. You cannot write those into a movie today because those sort of movies that Schwarzenegger made do not exist, and they cannot exist anymore. Which is also why I think Schwarzenegger is having a hard time coming back into the movie business because those movies are done.
Okay, next week. We're done. Thank you very much for tuning into the live feed. As you can see, this could go for another hour if we wanted it to. We'll be back next week. Tune us in on the Facebook page. Go to iTunes, Spotify, all those other places to catch us. Leave us a review. If you leave us a review and put your name on it, we may read it at the top of next week's show. So until then...
If it's a good review. If it's a bad review...
It's a good one. Well, yeah,
you
that's
suck.
True. No, I don't want to read bad ones. Never mind. Jake's right. Only good ones. We'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks so much.
Where is the stone? Dunkirk.
Dear. Oh, God.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.